News. I'm Dave McGrath. 8:10, The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next. Support for The Morning Show comes from Carthage College, where students can conduct NASA research, produce an original play, or join an in-house marketing agency as early as their freshman year. More information is available at carthage.edu. And we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm very excited to be able to welcome back into our studios, first of all, Deborah Karp, who has been with us before. She is the Community and Business Engagement Director at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. And she joins us on a very regular basis to talk about a special event in which she has a very direct hand, namely the Nonprofit Leadership Conference, which now happens at Parkside every other year. And the next leadership conference is coming up next Wednesday, November 17th, from 8 until 4 in the Student Center Ballroom. And this year's conference is centered on the very important principle of EDI, of equity, diversity, and inclusion, and the importance of nonprofits, particularly those that service diverse communities, should themselves be diverse and inclusive in their own makeup. And this is an important topic which is going to be explored with a number of different guest presenters, including WGTD's own Lynn Iaquinta, yeah, who is one of the presenters. And the keynote speaker for this year's conference is Dr. Andre Howard, who is Senior Director of Equity, Diversity, Inclusion, and Engagement, Alliance for Strong Families and Communities, at an agency called Social Current, which assists nonprofits, especially those engaged in human service agencies. And again, he is going to be giving the keynote address, and we have him via the telephone joining us for this conversation today. So Deborah Karp from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside and Dr. Andre Howard, we welcome both of you to The Morning Show.
Thank you. Good morning.
Glad you're here, Dr. Howard, with us, and we will engage with you in just a second. I want Deborah Karp, first of all, to give us a capsule history of the Nonprofit Leadership Conference. I think you've been involved in it from just about the very beginning.
Yeah, actually, I have. The first Nonprofit Leadership Conference was held in 2006, And we offered this event for about 10 years in a row every year. And about 2016, we started alternating, doing it every other year. But really, its purpose is to help nonprofit leaders to learn about topics that are relevant, up and coming. I mean, we touch on a variety of different subjects. It is a community design conference. We engage all kinds of people. We have a committee of about 16, 17 people who help to identify the important topics that we should be covering and help us find speakers and, panelists for our panel and so on.
We'll talk about some of the specific facets of the conference, different things are going to be offered in just a little bit, but I want to get to Dr. Howard. But Deborah Karp, can you just say a word about what prompted this invitation for you to have Dr. Andre Howard be the keynote speaker this year?
Well, actually, back in 2019, I attended conference in Milwaukee that was hosted by Dr. Howard's organization. And at the time, it was called Alliance for Strong Families and Communities or something along those lines. He'll tell you more about the change. It's very recent. But it was really, I thought, one of the best conferences I'd ever attended on the topic of equity. It was quite compelling, and I saw Dr. Howard present at that time. And so we reached out to the organization and got involved with Katie Lederer, and she joined our conference committee. And as we started planning for this year's conference, and we actually did a survey of the community to see what kinds of topics they were looking to hear about. And EDI rose right to the top. And we found that what we could do is cover all kinds of topics through an EDI lens. And really, the Social Current organization is a national organization, though it is based in Milwaukee. And so we have these experts in our backyard, and Dr. Howard presents all over the country, works with organizations across the country. And so we thought, well, he's never been down here in Kenosha to present, so we're happy to have him.
Very good. Dr. Howard, again, we're glad that you are joining us via the telephone this morning. Let's begin by hearing more about the organization with which you are working, which now is known as Social Current. As Deborah Karp touched on, once upon a time it was another organization, or it's kind of an amalgamation of a couple of different organizations, and maybe that melding occurred fairly recently. Sort that out for us, please.
Thank you. Again, thanks, Greg, for having me this morning. Thank you, Deborah, as well, for the invitation. Social Current is the result of two organizations that came together really to advocate for implementing equitable solutions to some of society's toughest challenges. So formerly known as the Alliance for Strong Families and Communities and the Council on Accreditation. So we've joined our forces together to be much more impactful, to really think about the start of something big. As we work and engage with thousands of social sector leaders who are called upon to activate the power of the sector to create a unified, intrepid, just, and purposeful network so that everyone can thrive. And so I have had the pleasure of being with the Legacy Alliance for over 10 years and really just excited about the new organization, Social Current. Jody Levinson is our CEO and president from New York. We have our headquarters in D.C. and our operations center here in Milwaukee. And so just excited about the possibilities in terms of a new organization.
So when it comes to Social Current and assisting a given nonprofit, typically how does that happen? I mean, what is the mechanism by which you connect with various nonprofits and human service agencies and give them assistance and guidance?
Yeah, we do that in a number of ways. We have our public policy office in D.C. that focuses on a lot of different issues related to child welfare and issues related to just the sector as a whole. We engage organizations in terms of wanting various resources and knowledge around equity and excellence and standards for the nonprofit sector as part of that process. We think about ourselves as kind of a partner in this work with many organizations that we work with across the country. And so we kind of bring together some of the resources, tools that nonprofits across the country will need in order to really execute on their mission, to be much more purposeful, strategic, intentional as part of that process. And so so together, we value the purpose, we value equity, we value action that really ultimately improves individual lives across this country. And so we kind of partner with organizations in many, many different ways as part of that process, conferences, learnings, trainings, as part of that whole package. And so we do it in different ways.
As Deborah Karp mentioned earlier, the focus of this year's Nonprofit Leadership Conference at Parkside, again coming up next Wednesday, is this concept of EDI, Equity, Diversity, Inclusion. I think one of the interesting things about that is that those are three words that are very closely related, and probably a lot of us use them almost interchangeably, and probably shouldn't. That is, each of those terms represents something very specific and perhaps distinct, and in understanding each of those three terms, we're going to have a much better understanding of a lot of what we're talking about. Would you mind taking us through those three terms, equity, diversity, and inclusion, and why there are three terms and why it's important to understand each of them?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, again, as you point out, Greg, that they all are purposeful and have their own intent in terms of bringing value to not only the nonprofit sector, but to, again, many communities across this country and really to everyone living in this nation, right? So as you think about, for example, diversity, which is really differences, you know, terms of differences, whether it's based on race, you know, differences in terms of being inclusive of our LGBTQ community, persons with disability, gender, age. I mean, we can go on and on and on. But diversity is a very powerful quotient in terms of thinking about this journey that we all need to be part of. And so when we think about diversity, it's the many different faces, lived experiences, the many different purposes that people come to the table and really begin to think about as part of that process. So diversity is really the differences around the table. The inclusion piece is ensuring that as we bring people together from different backgrounds based on a host of differences, that we can also make sure they have a voice at the table, right? That their voice is heard, that their lived experience is heard as part of that process. And so how do we continue to think about being intentional around being inclusive as we invite these differences to the table and making sure we have some safe space, brave space for that process to take place? And then, of course, the equity is access, right? Making sure folks have access to opportunities, access to making sure that whatever various systems folks are trying to engage in, that there's access, whether it's to justice or whether it's to health, or whether it's education, or whether it's the economics, that access is there. And so that's that equity quotient as you think about. So together, the equity, diversity, and inclusion pieces come together and really make for a very powerful way to think about how we as humanity need to advance and really need to co-create and live together. Organizations who are just focused on diversity, you know, we've got different races of folks or different differences in terms of folks at the table or within our organization is not enough. And so we have to continue to think about how we push to include and to ensure that inclusivity is part of that equation, as well as that there's this access piece that everyone has an opportunity to access through the equity lens is also part of that. So that's kind of what those three pieces come to understand. I do know this. I do know this. I do know that without EDI, right, you know, organizations, communities, D-I-E, die, right? Because, again, as we talk about the sustainability of communities, of organizations, this journey becomes so, so very important for all of us to participate in, and that's kind of how we see the EDI factors.
Interesting. So if I understand correctly, diversity is kind of about who is around the table and making sure that every face around that table isn't a white face or whatever. I mean, that it is a diverse group of people. But the inclusion is to ensure that that diverse group of people around that table, maybe more diverse than it once was, are all included in a meaningful way in what that organization does, and each of them is listened to. It's not just enough to be at the table. It's important to be a significant player at the table, and that's the inclusion piece.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yes. Yep. Absolutely. And then, of course, the equity piece, which is just as important, of course, is that everyone now has access, right? That I have just as much access to opportunities to engage as others without regard to the color of my skin or my sexual orientation, that I have access, I'm fairly able to access those opportunities. Mm-hmm. So that equity quotient is just as important. So.
For those of you just joining us, we're speaking today on the morning show with Dr. Andre Howard, who is going to be the keynote speaker for the upcoming nonprofit leadership conference at the University of Wisconsin Parkside, which will be next Wednesday, November 17th. In our studios is Deborah Karp, who is Community and Business Engagement Director at Parkside. She has a key hand in the coordination of the conference each and every year, including this one, which is focused on the concept of EDI, equity, diversity, inclusion. Dr. Howard, I noticed that the title of your keynote address is An Imperfect Journey, Infusing EDI into Organizational Culture. And I know that at least one other presentation at this year's conference is called Steps and Missteps on the EDI Journey. Both of those titles really suggest, and probably a lot of us are well aware, that this is not always easy and it doesn't always go well. Explain to our listeners why the title of your talk is An Imperfect Journey, and the value that you see in highlighting the difficulties that can be part of this.
Yes, yeah. We think about this journey again, and that's what we term it as, a journey, right? It's a process. It's one that takes time. It's one that has jagged edges. There's stop and start points along the way. Lots of congestion, lots of uncomfortability as part of the process. What I do is I push against the notion of, for example, organizations who want to take this equity journey and want to be perfect about it, or they want to make sure they are correct about it. And I'm saying to individual leaders, I'm saying to organizations, push that out the window. There's no such thing as perfection as you think about this equity journey. It's sloppy. It's messy. It's all of those things. But I would also suggest that within that messiness, that sloppiness, that uncomfortability is the real value that as leaders we can begin to come together and make some sense out of. And I think that's so important to continue to emphasize that, you know, this isn't a perfect journey. And part of that imperfect journey, of course, is that we give each other some space, some grace as we carry down this pathway, because we're not going to say everything perfectly or correct, quote unquote. We're not always going to get it right. Sometimes our actions are not going to align with what we truly intended for those actions to mean. And so it becomes awkward and becomes very uncomfortable. And so in this imperfect journey, we need to be able to give each other some grace as we falter, because we all will falter on this journey. But to understand, we're operating under the pretense and the condition that in order to advance this journey, we need to live in those times where it does become uncomfortable and make some sense out of that as we kind of build and learn and live together better. And that's that whole process and really the proposition in terms of this being an imperfect journey, that no journey is the same when you think about organizations or an individual experience, but that we understand that as we go into this, it's going to be tough. And I've seen a lot of organizations that have stop the work because it does get tough, right? And I'm saying, no, we can't do that. We have to lean into this imperfect journey with the understanding it's not always going to come out where one might feel good about it, right? But we can come together, engage each other, and have real conversation and think about strategies that we can employ so that we can learn a bit better or much more about each other's experiences and really become very potent in terms of what we're trying to achieve. So I hope that makes some sense in terms of that imperfect journey.
It does. Of course, for those who might be nervous about this or resistant to this, one of the points that is sometimes raised is, you know, whatever happened to hiring the best person to be your coordinator of such and such versus making choices that might involve somebody who is not the most qualified or one has maybe even serious reservations about, but it serves this other purpose in terms of EDI. I mean, what is your advice for somebody who kind of wrestles with that uncomfortable dilemma?
Yeah, I think there's a couple things to consider around that piece, Greg. I think first of all is the assumption, right, that historically, traditionally, particularly when I think about persons of color who have not had opportunities to participate fully, for example, in an organization at the leadership level, to not assume, because historically they have not had those opportunities to participate, that they are not qualified or that they are incompetent or there's some skill shortage there. So I think we have to change our lens around the understanding of folks who have not traditionally or historically shown up in these organizations. I think the other piece as we think about this is that this is a win proposition for all, right? And I think sometimes folks will say to themselves, well, this is a win-lose. Somebody's got to win, someone's got to lose. And I'm saying, no, we all can win as we think about having a much more diverse, equitable, inclusive, for example, talent pool in the organization that offers different perspectives, different lived experiences, and the like. And so when we do things like hiring and recruiting for individuals that may be diverse, we shouldn't look for culture fit. We should look for culture add in terms of what are we missing as part of that that equation. And so that's how I would kind of respond to that, is that it's okay to certainly feel a bit anxious and nervous about that, because, again, that's all part of that journey. But let us make sure we prepare ourselves on an individual level to challenge our assumptions, to challenge our shortcomings, our thinking about those who might be different, as a way to engage those who might be different that might come into the organization. So I would just add that piece to that.
That reminds me of something that is I saw someplace in the brochure for this conference, that it's important that nonprofits look at the matter of EDI as a resource, that when someone is brought into an organization who represents a positive step towards equity or diversity or inclusion, inclusiveness, that in and of itself is an asset. And that needs to be weighed in kind of the calculation in terms of who needs to be brought aboard. A final question for you, Dr. Howard. Deborah Karp mentioned that this conference in many respects is designed for nonprofits who are serving a diverse community but who themselves might not be all that diverse. That is, the nonprofit themselves might not be a very close reflection whatsoever of the community that they are seeking to serve. What kind of a problem do you think that is when a nonprofit is itself lacking in the area of EDI? In what way can that be a hindrance to the work that they are probably in very good faith working hard to do?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. A great question, Greg. I think key critical to all of that is to understand that as a lot of our nonprofit social service organizations across this country are serving that BIPOC, that Black, Indigenous, persons of color populations, that internally, from an organizational perspective, there should be some representation of that within the organization. So there should be a mirroring effect as part of that process. I think, again, historically, traditionally, the equity lens has not been adopted. And so we are encouraging organizations to adopt this equity lens as a way to be inclusive. I mean, as we talk about co-creating and serving populations, predominantly those populations which are persons of color populations, in a much more co-created, equitable way, we need to also have internally individuals who kind of represent some of those populations, right? So that a lived experience can be lifted, voice can be lifted as part of that experience, a better connecting piece should be part of that process as well. So what does that mean? It doesn't mean I'm asking folks or encouraging organizations to go and hire a bunch of folks of color to become part of their organization, right? Because the organization itself needs to prepare for those differences as they come into the organization, right? Our North Star is really baking equity into the culture of the organization. So it just becomes a natural way of how we roll, how we operate, how we connect with each other, how we connect with our colleagues within the organization. And so if the culture of the org is not prepared for equity, then, you know, hiring a lot of persons of color just to be in the organization, where you may have diversity very strongly, but, you know, rarely do they stay around because, again, there's not support for those differences, then that can certainly mean disaster. So I think critical to all of this is just ensuring that organizations understand historically, you know, we have not paid attention to some of this equity. And I would also say there's lots of organizations doing a lot of stuff around this EDI because it's become so pronounced in our society really recently and really throughout the decades and centuries, if you think about it. But over the last 18 to 24 months, folks are really pushing DEI efforts through doing a whole bunch of stuff. I say you need to be intentional and strategic as you think about how you get differences within the organization and how those differences in the organization mirrors the communities that you co-create with. My last piece, Greg, is this, is that I think we have to, you know, here we get sticky. I know we have to acknowledge historically trauma that has been done to people based upon their sexual orientation or the color of their skin or their gender. We've got to acknowledge that. There's real history there as we start to dig into that, that has shown us for centuries of how systems and inequities have become inequitable and not fair for everyone. We need to acknowledge that. But critical for organizational leaders to understand, though, is we all must be part of this journey, right? So when we talk about lived experiences, this can't just be about black folk, brown folk. This has to be about all of us as we take this journey together. And so we may all be at different spaces and places at this journey, and that's fine. But we need to all agree that this is the journey for all of us. Acknowledge what's happened historically, but let's move forward together in a way that allows us to give each other some grace, some space to grow, to learn, and to take the mask off and be who we really are and show up as we really are in those organizations. And so I think that is so critical as we think about those differences, as we think about why we need to have in the organization faces and experiences that mirror the individuals that we serve in the various communities across this country.
Very well put. Dr. Andre Howard with Social Current, who is going to be the keynote speaker at the Nonprofit Leadership Conference next Wednesday, speaking early in the day and then also serving as kind of a wrap-up for the conference towards the end of the day, drawing all of the threads together. Dr. Howard, it was great to meet you today and to hear from you, and I appreciate you making time in your schedule to join us on the morning show today. Thank you so much, and best wishes with all the good work that you are doing.
Thank you so much, and see you next week.
All right. Thank you again. You're listening to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Deborah Karp remains here in the studio, Community and Business and Engagement Director at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. Deborah Karp, what would you like to tell us in terms of some of the other presentations and offerings in next week's conference?
Yeah, sure. We've got four breakout sessions after the keynote speech by Dr. Howard. One is going to be about how organizations can effectively use data and not use it in a misleading way. We also have a really, I think, a newer kind of idea to think about is equity in fundraising and fund development, marketing. How do we look at the way we're presenting our materials, who we're reaching out to? I think the premise of it, and this is being led by Len Iaquinta.
From WGTD.
Yes, from WGTD. And Len is working with a woman from Kansas City, Jocelyn Morning. And they've been presenting this session at national conferences. And in any case, they're looking from, like, we have been a very donor-centric approach to fundraising, and how do you take it to, and create a more community-centric approach? And so that's, I think, going to be a really exciting session. We've also got Sheila Mayhorn from the YWCA of Wisconsin, and she's going to be presenting a session on strengthening capacity to diversify staff and leadership. And that's not just about hiring practices. That's also how do you retain people? How do you create a culture of inclusivity? And then finally, we've got another breakout by Marvin Bembry. Marvin is a John Maxwell disciple, leadership expert, and he is going to be talking about inclusive leadership and how it leads to better program outcomes for diverse clients, which is really important in the nonprofit sector. I didn't mention that the data workshop is being led by Kevin Maher, who is with Building Our Future, a local nonprofit organization that is part of a Strive initiative very dedicated to issues of equity and diversity in its mission. And then finally, Tamara Coleman from the Shalom Center is going to be our panel moderator, and we are bringing in four different organizations who are at different stages of their EDI journey. The United Way of Racine County, Alexa Haig is going to be the panelist. She's the CEO of that organization. They've been working a lot on their EDI journey for quite a while now. Quentin Price from Milwaukee Sports Organization, Ahmad Kwai from the United Way, YMCA, Racine Family YMCA is going to be there, and then two people from First Stage in Milwaukee. So we have different size organizations on that panel, different levels of resources, and they're all going to talk about where they are, what's working, what hasn't worked, and what we're hoping is that the people in the audience at the conference are going to learn from the other people's experiences.
Right. So that's the one I highlighted earlier called Steps and Missteps on the EDI Journey, and I'm so glad, because I think it is a big mistake to, in a sense, sugarcoat this or shy away from some of the aspects of this that are very, very tricky and in certain cases even controversial. But,
yeah.
I mean, meeting it head on, I think that is absolutely the right thing to do. You mentioned before we went on the air that this conference is already looking to be very well attended and with quite a diverse group in terms of all kinds of different organizations that are already represented. For those who are interested in being part of this, what do they need to do?
Well, you can register by going to UW Parkside's website, and actually it's just uwp.edu/NPLC, Nonprofit Leadership Conference. Actually, if you just go on the Parkside website and search Nonprofit Leadership Conference, you'll come right to the page, and there's a registration link there, also a phone number. That would be pretty easy. The conference registration is, I think it's still open online. We will take people walking in on the day of the conference as well. The registration starts at 7:30 on November 17th. The conference is in the Student Center at UW Parkside.
And is it only in person? I mean,
it is.
Okay, so if people want to participate in this, you need to be there. I know that it's made very clear on the website that very careful COVID protocols are in place. And so you're working really hard to keep everybody safe who's going to be participating. And we should mention that towards the end of the day is a networking reception in which people really get to meet their counterparts at other nonprofit organizations. So.
Yeah, that networking reception is sponsored by Leadership Kenosha and Leadership Racine, and we're hoping to introduce some of the current cohort of leadership program participants to some of the people in the nonprofit sector for potential matches as volunteers and board members.
Wonderful. Very, very good. Deborah Karp, it's always great to reconnect with you, and I'm excited that we could talk about what sounds like a really beneficial and exciting conference again coming up next Wednesday, November 17th, 8 to 4, in the Student Center Ballroom at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. Deborah Karp, thank you for being in our studios today and being part of this morning show today.
Thanks, Greg.
Here is part two of today's program. I'm holding in my hands an absolutely lovely book both to look at and to read, with a very important theme at its heart. The book is called The Proudest Color. And in this lovely children's book, picture book, we have a central character of Zara, who loves to think of the world around her and her interactions and her own feelings in bright colors. But she is also trying to come to terms with the fact that her skin is brown, unlike the skin color of nearly all of her schoolmates. And so it is kind of a journey that this beautiful youngster goes on, and we follow that journey in this book called The Proudest Color. And the book was created by a gifted couple, Sheila Modir and Jeff Kashu. Sheila Modir is a pediatric psychologist, and Jeffrey Kashu is a marriage and family therapist. And they happen to be Middle Eastern Americans who have worked very tirelessly on various issues related to diversity and equality. And this is their first children's book that they have created together. It's published by Familius, again called The Proudest Color. Sheila Modir and Jeff Kashu, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you so much for having us. We're really excited to be here, Greg.
Good morning. This is a pleasure. Thank you.
It's a lovely, lovely book. It really, really is. So your daily professional lives have nothing, at least directly, to do with creating children's books. So tell me how it occurred to you that this was something that should be done. I mean, that the world needed this book and that the two of you were the ones who should write it.
Yeah, absolutely. So this summer, in the wake of George Floyd's murder and the subsequent protests for social justice across the country, we recognized we had an opportunity to do something, and we weren't quite sure what. And reflecting on our own experiences, especially Sheila's growing up in some rural areas of Illinois, being the only person of color oftentimes in her communities, we recognized that this was just a really good opportunity for us to give children who are watching what was happening, for families who weren't sure how to talk about it with their children, a resource to help them understand and process, but then also to cope and build resilience in the face of it. You know, we understand that we can't stop prejudice and racism and discrimination right away, but we definitely want to be able to control what is in our control, which is how we confront it. And also one thing I do want to mention at the top, if that's okay, is that we are donating our author's proceeds as well to the ACLU and other local social justice organizations here in California.
Hmm. I would love to hear more about whatever personal experiences you were able to draw upon in writing this book. Do any particularly powerful memories come to mind?
Yeah, I think that I actually grew up in Illinois, and I, similar to Zahra, I was one of the few people of brown skin tone in my class growing up. And so I was always aware of my appearances and the inability to blend in. I think in a class photo, you can see me a mile away, that I definitely, you know, with my darker hair and darker skin tone, was standing out amongst my classmates. And so a lot of this book was based off of how I oftentimes, when I write about my experiences for autobiographical statements that I have to do for graduate school and so on, I talk about how I often felt like a crayon that wasn't used as much. And when I was used, I was the brightest color on the page. And I was able to take this experience and become a really good therapist from it, because I'm able to connect with all types of patients and be able to really understand their experiences, because I'm someone that was able to take, maybe I wasn't picked as often, but when I was, I added so much more to the page or to a room. And so when we were sitting down to write, I thought of that experience and I was really able to channel it. I also think that for a lot of Middle Eastern Americans, same with Jeff as well, there after September 11th, discrimination towards this community increased tremendously and continues to increase. And so I think that that was a really formative experience for many of us in the community. And that's the experience that really we draw on when we think about discriminations that we have experienced.
Mm-hmm. I gave the very briefest of summaries of the sort of the essential plot of the story, but why don't you tell the story to our listeners in just a little bit more detail in terms of what this young girl named Zahra experiences.
Of course. So you first meet Zahra. She's described as somebody who sees and feels in color. So we bring in some emotional identification into the book as well, just for a mental health theme. And then as she prepares for her first day of school, she's being put to bed by her mother, and they're discussing how proud they are of all the colors they felt during the day, but especially the one that stays and that they see when they look in the mirror, which is the color brown, and her mother admiring the different shades of brown even between them. And when Zahra goes to school the next day, it's her first day, she recognizes that nobody else looks like her. And she pauses for a moment, but then remembers how proud she is of her color. And it instills a sense of confidence in her. Soon after that, a white classmate of hers points out that Zahra doesn't look like anyone else and puts her down for it. And that causes Zahra then to question her pride in her color. And so when she comes home, she tells her parents about this, and her parents then engage her in an evidence-based practice called racial socialization, which is socializing her to others in her world who are of her skin tone, who have gone on to do amazing and incredible things in her world, to rebuild that sense of pride in her skin tone and her race and others who look like her.
Can you tell us what it was like to shape this story and the kinds of questions that you wrestled with in terms of exactly how you wanted to explore this story? Because, of course, you had an infinite number of possible choices at every stage, and you were doing this for the first time. So help us understand what the process was like for crafting this book.
I think a children's book is just a whole different area. You know, I'm used to writing dissertations or scholarly articles, so having to sit down and write things of such depth in a developmentally appropriate manner, or in a way that, you know, five-year-olds can understand it or parents can feel comfortable talking about it, was definitely a new avenue for us. So really being able to shape a story that is approachable, relatable, and can really stay with someone. You know, we want it to be memorable because we want this story to be able to elicit change and for children to be able to remember Zahra's journey when they enter their first day of school or when they enter a classroom or a store and they don't feel like anybody else in that room. So really, it was definitely a process to find out how to be able to do this that in the right language.
Yeah, and I'll add to that as well. You know, with the interaction that she has with her classmate who discriminates against her, we had an interesting process even with our editor in determining, you know, how we wanted to close up that story, making it developmentally appropriate. And, you know, it is a children's book at the end of the day, but also not putting the onus on the person of color to heal the story. So we were able to institute some elements of anti-racism as well in that part of the story. So it was fun crafting this book.
I wonder if it was harder than you expected it to be, and I only ask that because I think a lot of people kind of make blithe assumptions about how difficult it is to craft a book for children versus a book written for adults. And obviously, it's shorter, fewer pages, many fewer words, and that sort of thing, and yet it has its own challenges that can be tremendously difficult. Was it for you?
Definitely. I think that's a great question, because you know what the most difficult part was is there's so many important and incredible people of color that we wanted to include in this book. So there's a part where Zahra's parents explain to her all the important people that share her skin tone. You know, so we're talking about Barack Obama, Frida Kahlo, Malala Yousafzai, Martin Luther King Jr. And so she is thinking of all of these incredible people and relating to them. And so when Jeff and I were sitting down and writing about each person, you know, Cesar Chavez, there's so many that we could have included. And I think that that was definitely an area of struggle because we wanted to make sure that we represented the entire brown community. But fortunately, there's so many incredible people to pick from, but unfortunately, we weren't able to put it in all of them in a children's book. So I think that's an area that I wish I could just like have this comprehensive list for children to be able to access, because there's so many important people out there.
That's a very moving part of the book, that's for sure. By the way, we would certainly be remiss if we didn't make mention of the talented artist who is responsible for the illustrations. What do you want to tell us about her?
Yeah, Monica is just such a brilliant illustrator. We're so fortunate that Similius found her and shared her with us. You know, she brought in a lot of her own story, her own experience as well. It was just a completely positive experience crafting this story with her. I mean, and we were just blown away every time she came back with something. There's elements in the book, too, that she introduced that we hadn't expected that really elevated the process as well. She made the book very neurodiverse, accessible too for kids who learn a little bit differently. She introduced a path, like a crayon path of color that trails Zahra throughout her story that changes color based on her emotions that she identified earlier on. She also brought in this adorable little cat that's her kind of partner, who is with her through all the highs and lows of the story. So we're just so fortunate that Monica took this project on with us and brought it to a level we never really could have imagined.
The book, at the very end, includes a note to parents and caregivers, which is really a marvelous addition to the proceedings. And I don't remember seeing anything quite like this before in a children's book. Explain what the reader finds here on this page called, again, A Note to Parents and Caregivers.
Yeah, so in this, when we wrote this book, we were really wanting to make sure we had this note because we want to use this book as a tool, or we would like parents to use this book as a tool as they explain race and racism to their child. There really isn't a book out there that really openly and explicitly talks about racism among children in this age group. And so this is very much explicitly an experience happens and skin color is questioned. So we wanted to make sure that parents had a guide to be able to navigate sometimes this difficult or for them sometimes an uncomfortable conversation. And so in this guide, we have some different pointers and tips on how to be able to have this conversation. For example, we don't want parents to feel like they have to talk about everything all at once, you know, to sit the child down and have this deep discussion about racism. This is a conversation that should be ongoing in the home. It should be something that we don't take a colorblind approach, right? There's families that say, you know, we don't see color and we are all in this together, which is not necessarily true. There are groups that are treated historically unfairly and continue to be treated unfairly. So we want families to be able to have these conversations, all of them based in the current reality that we're in, multiple conversations as a child goes through different developmental stages, and to be able to use tools like children's books and even tools like Crayola's skin tone crayons and markers. Those are incredible. Or dolls that portray different races and ethnicities. So to be able to help expose their child to diverse groups. So those are just some of those tips that we put in there, and we hope that parents can be able to utilize.
It's a really lovely list. I really think that's neat. A last quick question. You touched on the fact that the period immediately after 9/11 was difficult for people of Middle Eastern descent. I wonder what it has been like for you to experience this 20th anniversary, which was just commemorated. I suspect it might have brought back some difficult memories for you.
Yeah, thank you so much for that question. You know, of course, it's such a mixed day for us because it obviously brings about all the pain and sadness for everyone who was lost so senselessly that day. And additionally, you're just constantly reminded of, you know, I can think back to when I was in high school and, you know, showing up to my different classes and feeling all the eyes on me, or a teacher even asking, you know, what should we do? Should we nuke them? Should we go to war with them? I don't know, it's like, you know, I have family there. Maybe we should take a different approach. You know, and just that, you know, it kind of bolsters your sense of identity at the same time of also now having to constantly think about how it's brought up in conversation. It's something I can speak for myself. I haven't really shook to this day being Palestinian American and, you know, always wondering, do I mention that fact or not, or do I just say I'm, you know, Middle Eastern or Arab descent?
a difficult day for all of us, and a lot of important lessons we hope have been learned. Will you be writing another children's book together, do you think?
We hope so. We definitely hope that this isn't our last one. We have a lot of different mental health themed messages that we'd like to impart on children. This is, you know, we see this in our therapy offices, so we want to make sure that we're capturing and writing about it for parents.
This book, again, is lovely and called The Proudest Color. It's published by Familius. Its co-authors Sheila Modir and Jeff Kashu. Thank you so much for giving the world this lovely book, and thank you for being part of The Morning Show today.